I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today's episode is a conversation about storytelling and the power of story. It's not a typical episode in that Bob and I aren't actually asking the questions. This is part of a panel that I did at the National Conference of State Legislatures annual summit in Tampa about a month ago, side by side with the always magnificent storyteller Donna Washington. Tim Story and NCSL was kind enough to bring us back. If you remember, we spoke in 2019, the two of us with Bob, actually, when the convention was in Nashville. This conversation covers, in general, the same theme, but I'll say that there are a lot of new ideas I've had, and Donna has as well, you know, thinking more in this time of division, and just ways that story can mend that, and the ways that, in some ways, story is responsible for that. So I hope you guys enjoy this, and again, Donna Washington, so fantastic. If you ever get a chance to hear her tell a story, take it. I just got my son her new book, Boo Stew. It's beautiful. So links to all that in the episode description and on the website. Just a few things before we go into that conversation, though. First of all, big shout out to Kim Burns, who kindly picked Road to Now, our conversation earlier this year with Annette Gordon Reed, as one of his favorite podcast moments of 2021. Just absolutely, me and Bob were so happy about this. Texting back and forth about it when we saw that it was posted. So thank you to Kim Burns. And I can't even say how much it means that a person who has really shaped the way that I understand the past and Bob understands the past has taken the time to listen to our show. So special thanks to him. And if you want to check it out, the link to the clip that he picked, as well as a very kind introduction explaining it, that's through Hark Audio. And you can link to that through any of our social media. We've got that post and that link up there. If you want to check it out, please do. But you can also go straight to the episode through our website. It was episode 198. And you can go straight there at rtnpod.me/198. So again, quite an honor. Now, finally, speaking of appreciation, patrons, thank you for everything you do. And I'm happy to announce now that the people have spoken. We took a poll on patreon.com/theroadtonow. And the Road to Now Patreon holiday trivia party with fantastic prizes that I will be hosting will be Tuesday, December 21st at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's 6 p.m. Pacific. And can't wait for it. This is going to be so much fun. For those of you guys who are regular attendees to our Patreon when we were doing it monthly when everything was in lockdown, I miss you guys. So looking forward to seeing you there and to handing out some great prizes, including a brand new copy of Nora Guthrie's new book on Woody Guthrie, which we spoke about a few weeks ago. Guys, we'll be back with another new episode next week. In the meantime, take care. Thank you for your support. And we hope you enjoy this conversation brought to you by Tim Story and the good people at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Take care.
Hey, wow, that's a good looking room. I'm really happy that you are here. My name is Tim Story. I am the executive director of the National Conference of State Legislatures, NCSL, as we are commonly known. Now, perhaps you noticed my last name is Story, if you haven't.
Welcome to the Tim Storytelling Panel.
The Tim Storytelling Panel. So I guess there was some natural inclination that this would be the case. This is where I'd wind up. My goal is really just to be the guide a little bit. I'm sort of just the moderator, and I have two top level pros to really guide us and let us talk about story, maybe hear a few stories, I have a feeling. So let me just introduce our guests and experts and master storytellers and master instructors, Dr. Ben Sawyer. Thank you, Ben, for being here.
Well, you'll hear from me in a second.
Yes. And then to also my right and your general left is Donna Washington. Donna's from the great state. We're all from the great state of North Carolina. I forgot about that. We're all Tar Heels. But you grew up in the Army. She landed in North Carolina. Donna is one of the nation's most gifted and outstanding storytellers, has won award after award after award for her storytelling, but does a lot of her work in schools, is also an award-winning author who just got a super awesome contract for her new book because it sold out, right? Like crazy, called Boo Stew, a children's book. Yeah, it's actually really awesome. All right, so the real point of this session is talk about stories, tell a few stories. I'll start with you, Donna. Tell us, I think I really want to ask two questions. Why are stories important, and what makes a great story? So let's start with, why are stories important?
The reason why stories are important, this is an easy one, I think. Our brains are hardwired for stories. They're not hardwired for numbers. I can't add to save my life. They're not hardwired for facts, because people question facts. But if you want to really get underneath someone, tell them a story. I'm gonna tell you a short story to explain what I mean by that. I was in a school a couple of weeks ago. Little African-American boy came in with his class. Well, actually, we weren't in the school. We were outside, because I was performing. And he sat with his back to every adult in the room, or out in the area, which was clever. He sat catty-cornered. You could either see his sides or the back of his head. And he talked to the little kids around him, but he wouldn't look at any of the grown-ups. Then I started performing. Within 3 minutes, he sat down, turned around, and did this the entire time. He started waving his hands around when we were doing. He started participating. And when it was over, because we were outside, the librarian started breaking down the materials because we were worried it was going to rain on us. He came up to me. He said, "Excuse me." "Yes." He said, "Are you coming back after lunch?" I said, "No, honey, I have to go." He said, "Huh." And then the librarian stepped in front of me and said, "But that book she showed us, it's going to be in our library." He said, "Good, I'll come down and get it." And he left. And all three of the teachers, they're staring at him. And I said, "What was that about? That's normal." She said, "No, that kid hasn't spoken to any adult since school started this year. He has been completely shut down. You just turned him back on." Stories create community. They make a place for all of us to find a way to talk to each other. Not at each other or over each other or through each other. And they do it by bringing us all to the same place so we can find a way to talk to each other. And that's why they're important. They connect us to each other in a way that nothing else can. All right, how do you tell a good story? First, you need to bring everybody together, which is not an easy thing. For instance, I'm gonna say one word. Robin. Raise your hand if you saw a bird. Hands down. Raise your hand if you saw a person you know named Robin. Hands down. Raise your hand if you saw Robin Hood. Hands down. Raise your hand if you saw Batman's sidekick.
Oh.
Hands down. Raise your hand if I said Robin and you thought about somebody taking stuff that does not belong to them, robbing a bank. I just created a community in here. We're all on the same page. We're all laughing at the same thing. No matter what you came in here with, right now all we have is Robin. I could tell you anything and you'd follow me anywhere. Stories do that.
That's such a perfect segue. Ben, you just want to give up right now, or would you like to add to that?
Thank you guys for having me.
Why are stories important, Ben?
Well, let me start off by telling a story that I tell my classes. When I was a kid, so I grew up like in the 80s, right, watching boxing. And I don't know if you guys remember boxing back then. It was like Tyson, Foreman, right? Like all these guys who were giants still in my head, right? It was heavyweight days. And we were broke, so we couldn't watch the fights. But my mom had a friend who would record them on VHS so we could watch them later on. And I don't know if y'all remember, in the 80s, those Saturday night fights on HBO were like the hugest deal. I mean, I would try to like go over to my friend's house and watch them. But one of the tapes I remember, like, there'd be the big fight, but there'd always be those early card bouts. And at that time, nobody cared about like the featherweight guys. But if they got on HBO at that time, it was such a huge deal, right? I mean, you could make or break your entire career if you put on a good fight, put on a good show. So in this one fight, I might have been like 11 years old when I was watching this. These two guys go out there, like featherweight guys, and they, in the first round, go at each other like we used to box in the barn. Right? I don't know if you ever went out boxing. I'm sorry. Okay, I should say, I'm a redneck, so I grew up in the country. But we used to go box, and you just go flail and fist at each other, right? Because but a boxer knows to conserve energy. These guys went at each other like that. And after the first round, they went back to their corner just beat. And I think one guy had a better manners than the other one, because the one guy clearly told his boxer, let that guy wear himself out. They go back out. The one guy comes at him as hard as he can. The other guy just backs up. And you can see about a minute to a minute and a half in, that guy who's been swinging his hands get real heavy. This guy sees his opportunity. He's back in the corner. He goes out. He just goes out basically with all of his weight. And he shifts. But what he didn't realize was that his boot had gotten caught in the corner post. So when he goes to swing, his foot gets caught, twists around. He drops. His bones snap in half. Out of skin. Guy looks at his leg and passes out. Did you feel that? Isn't that insane? You felt it, right? Now, here's the thing. I didn't tell you anything about that boxer. I didn't tell you their race. I didn't tell you their faith. I didn't tell you their politics. I didn't tell you where they were born. All I told you was that it was a human being who went through a very traumatic experience, and you felt it. But that was just a story, wasn't it? That's the power of story right there. Is you find the common thing. Now, we can all imagine something like that happening to us. That's because even if it hasn't happened to us, we live in a story in which that is a possible outcome of something that we do. And so that's how I think when you think about stories, you find that empathy. And that is one of the things that separates us humans, which I think is why we're such good storytellers. So like you're saying, hardwired to tell stories. But a story at its core, you know, I'm a historian, right? So I think about these things in a pretty structured way. Stories make sense of a complicated world. Every one of you guys knows, I mean, I'm assuming most people do this. Sometimes you just lay awake in bed thinking about something dumb you said like 10 years ago. Anybody ever do that? The shower moments. Anyway, you're just like, oh God. Yeah, you think about things. So you know that you're a complex person. You know all your complexities. And yet I'm talking to everybody in here and navigating this world without having to know everything that ever made you scream or everything that ever made you a champion. Things get simple. Right, so the way that we do it is we tell a story, and communities have a shared story that allows us to connect with each other, like Donna said. So I think a good story is one that begins with a premise that everyone can jump on board with. And the more that you siphon off, the more assumptions you make where you're not thinking about the people that you're speaking to, the less you're going to get people in on that story. So I think the core of a good story and what makes it is thinking about it as an exercise in empathy, and then telling a story that everybody can be on board with. And as people that are involved in setting policy, you have to have a story that not only has a shared origin, but you have to connect that shared origin we imagine ourselves with a possible future. And as long, the more seamless that can be in the way you tell the story, the more likely you are to sway people to your side.
Yeah. And I'm gonna jump in on that. What's really kind of cool about the story that you just told is that it has to do with the sort of graduation of bringing us along in a story. So another good technique to tell a story is to start in a common place. So you were talking about VHS tapes and HBO and the fights. How many of you watched boxing? Yeah.
Yeah, no.
It wasn't the boxing that brings us along in the story. How many of you remember VHS tapes?
How many don't?
We're not asking that question yet.
Okay.
Mr. Stories.
How many of you guys were like, so is boxing just UFC without using your leg?
Yeah, right.
So the point is that the story is about boxing. But most people in here don't watch boxing.
Yeah.
And don't know anything about it. Don't know the rules. Don't know, like, could maybe you could name Muhammad Ali, right, and a couple other boxers possibly, and yet we followed that story and those people because the story isn't about boxing. All right, now boxing happened in the story and that was the pivotal thing going on, but that's not what that story was about. So when you are trying to tell a story that reaches people, it doesn't matter what the people look like. It doesn't matter where the people are. We can have empathy and connect to people who are really different from us because they are human. But also, if they have shared understanding of something, it's not the boxing. It's the VHS tapes.
This is why Donna is better at this than I am.
It's not a competition.
I'm like, here's a good story, and she's like, here's why it's good. And I was like, that is why it's good. Thank you.
There's no wagering. There's no wagering.
That was a great story. I love that story. But yeah, and it's the same thing. One of my favorite kinds of stories are scary stories. I love scary stories.
Because that's common, right? I mean, that's a common thing. Yeah.
Well, look, I love the smell of frightened children in the morning. That's one thing. But I love scary stories because they're not about the scary thing. They're about overcoming your fear. They're about being scared in a safe place so that you can move beyond it. I tell this incredibly ridiculous story called Red Red Lips that is not scary at all, that terrifies children, absolutely terrifies them. But this little boy is scared of the dark, and he goes to the window after his mother turns the lights off, and he hears his son, it goes, crackle, crackle, crackle. I've lost all the five-year-olds at that point. He goes to the window, there's somebody looking in at him, and she has black, black hair and green, green skin and red, red lips and long red fingernails. And he runs back and forth to the bed, terrified, calling his mother in, and finally she says to him, there's nothing in this room scarier than what's in your imagination. And so the next time she shows up, he asks, what do you do with your red lips and your red, red fingernails? And she says, you wanna know? And he says, okay. And she raises her long red fingernails to her red lips and she goes, and all the kids fall out. I got a call, or I should say an email, from a mother who said that every night her five-year-old, who now is probably 12, was afraid to go up the stairs to go to bed. She'd have to carry her. And so that night, after she heard that story, she stopped at the foot of the stairs, looked up the stairs, and went, and walked up the stairs. The stories are not about the things that, like the big stuff that moves you, it's about the humanness of them. So when you can find the humanness in your stories, in whatever it is you're trying to reach, that's when they are effective.
So I was thinking about the fact that we are constantly told by the media generally, in the world of legislatures and politics, how divided we are, right? There are red teams and blue teams, and there are rural and urban and rich and poor and black and white. And so it's all about how you can divide and divide and divide people into groups. So when we're being constantly divided, you know, why is it important? And what's the magic to getting people who may really think very differently about where this country should go, where their state should go? How do you bring them together? That's a big question, right?
I've got.
You got the answer. Give us the answer, Ben.
I think it's interesting that people keep on telling us how divided we are. And yet when I sit down to talk to people, I get along with them. And I don't know if that's because I'm a person that just the way that I think, but I just find that wherever I go, I get along. There's a lady in our neighborhood, Miss Darlene. She's a sweet old lady. She's a sweet country lady. They don't make ladies like that anymore. All right, and I love her, and she loves my son, who's 6 years old, and you know, she just gives him hugs, and she says, you're my favorite little boy, and it's one of the great relationships in my neighborhood. I got no clue what Miss Darlene's politics are. Never came up. Doesn't usually come up in most conversations you had. You talk about your kids, you talk about work, you talk about the struggles you're going through with people, right? And then you cut on the TV, and you're just like, well, that lady might be your enemy. It's like, what? But this gets to the art of storytelling, and this is like something that I was talking about in my class the other day, because we're at the point in class where we're talking about the history of slavery, and students reasonably, and this is a good question, they say, how could you live in a place where you treated people like that? How do people just get up and deal with life? I said, well, you got to understand that everybody's got a story, right? And there's stories to justify everything. But stories can be great because they can unify us. But there are certain elements to divisive stories. And I think the most powerful one, and this is certainly today what we're going through, is not to the extreme that we were going through then. But the key thing that always makes me worried when I see it is when a group of people learns about another group of people from someone else. And that's what I see. And, you know, I say, how could you treat people like that? How could you treat black people like that under slavery? I was like, well, they never got a chance to tell their own stories. The people who told their stories were the people who had very much interest in keeping them in that place. So they said, don't even talk to them, right? They're this, they're that. And so therefore, what we're doing is okay. But that's a story about those people that those people didn't get to participate in. When I see these things now, when I cut on these political talking heads, right, and we got to remember that these folks aren't journalists, they are commentators. There's a clear divide in that I think people often forget about. But what those people do is they take the news and they put them into a story. And they often, I hear from commentators on the TV, don't even listen to these Republicans, don't even listen to these Democrats. Every Democrat wants to bring down the American system. Every Republican wants to storm the White House. And I'll be damned if I don't ever run into anybody who wants to do that in my life. And I just wonder if we would stop listening to the people who tell us we're divided and that say, by the way, we're divided. You should keep on listening to me because I'm going to tell you what you need to do to deal with those people over there. And we actually started talking to each other. I mean, what do most people want? I've been all over the world. Most people want enough food to eat. They want a roof over their head, and they want the idea that their children can have as good or better life than they have. And that's a hell of a lot more different than a debate over tax policy, right? We can have those differences. That's good. That's a thriving democracy. But at the end of the day, if we let someone else tell the story, they can take the humanity out of those folks. Mm. And once you lose the humanity in a group of people, you've primed yourself for a very inhumane situation.
So who tells the story matters a lot.
Yes.
Another thing that I think is kind of difficult in this is that everybody has a foundational story, every single one of us. A story that is true, as far as we know to be true. And we believe our foundational stories. We believe them. They are made up of all the things that we believe and all the things we don't believe. So if you told me parts of your foundational stories, like where your bedrock is, I could tell you what faith you belong to. Because those are the stories you believe. I could tell you what part of the country you grew up in. Because the stories that make up who you are built over all these years. And they are hard to let go of. If somebody approaches you and starts talking to you about something that you foundationally believe, and they're saying things that challenge that, your brain interprets that the same way as if they are stabbing you. Mm. You get fight or flight. How many of you have seen this, where you're just talking to someone and they lose their mind?
Nobody in
and
this
And suddenly,
room.
Nah, it's that's up. Never happened, right? Never. And then suddenly, you're not having a discussion, you're having a fight. And you don't even know what happened. It's like, excuse me, I don't know why you're so upset. I'm upset because you said this. You could just say I don't agree. You don't have to fight me about it. But we get those hair triggers, and part of it is that we are human. So when you start talking to someone about something they truly believe and you don't agree, it really makes people uncomfortable. And when you do that, you're going to get either people who run away from you and won't talk to you anymore, or people who are going to fight you. Now, I often am invited into homogenous communities. I think that's the best way to say that. And I'm often invited into homogenous communities by arts councils and librarians.
Ah, yes.
Because they're pretty sure their population needs exposure. So it isn't, there are a whole bunch of them, but probably one of the more amusing ones is I was invited into an homogenous community, into a small library. And there were pictures of me all over the place. And so I come in, and as you can see, I'm barefoot. I'm a barefoot performer. I've been a performer for 35 years. This is the only job I've ever had as a grown-up person. I graduated from Northwestern University, and since then I've been touring the world telling people stories. It's all I've ever done. So I'm not fit for anything else. This is the only thing I know how to do. So I go into this library, I take my shoes off, I put everything away, and into the library come a huge number of people, which I think is funny, but inevitably happens when I'm in a community like this. They're all staring at me like I'm from the zoo. And inevitably some kid will say something. My favorite one is this little kid comes and he stops stock still in the middle of the library and announces, "She's black!" And his mother, well, like I didn't know.
Right, right, there's that.
And his mother is mortified. Because apparently you're not supposed to say it out loud. So his mother like goes like, shh. And I almost felt like saying, because if he didn't say it out loud, nobody would know. But she has him sit down. She's mortified. She's bright red. She sits him down and we start telling stories. And whenever I'm in a small community like that, I like to pick stories that are from the area. Stories that they might have heard from grandparents or great-grandparents or aunts or uncles. And by the time it's over, and they're all participatory, everyone's laughing and we're playing, we're having a great time, and we're leaving this library, and I hear kids saying to their parents, "You already knew that story." It's accusatory. "How come you didn't tell me that story? I haven't heard that story since my uncle. You knew that story?" And the payoff for me is watching kids and their parents walk back to their cars or walk out telling versions of the stories that I told. But I went from, "Oh my God, look at this, what is in our library?" to everyone's uncle and aunt and grandma in 45 minutes. They don't care where I came from. They don't care what I believe. They don't care any of that. This is about the building of bridges. Stories have this amazing way of bridging generations, of bridging language. I'm often brought into schools where they don't speak English and they're learning English. My favorite, I was in Taiwan speaking to people who were learning Spanish. And I don't speak Spanish, but I know some stories with Spanish words.
How much Taiwanese do you speak?
I speak no Chinese, no Taiwanese. I speak nothing.
Okay.
They barely speak English, and they barely speak Spanish, and I'm speaking English, and I barely speak Spanish. We had the best time! Because storytelling is really visual, and it also is really visceral. So after it's over, I'm trying to draw pictures of some of the things in the stories that my Spanish wasn't good enough to reach their Spanish. And at one point, someone raises their hand and says, "It is a good thing you tell stories, you bad drawer." So stories bridge all kinds of gaps, and it doesn't matter. Like, your little boy doesn't care what this lady believes in. If we find the humanity in ourselves. And also the pundits, right? They're telling us we're not the same. I get so mad at people who say, "Real Americans." It's like real Kraft cheese. What does that even mean? What does that mean? And that's another thing. We get terms and they don't mean anything, but we already have foundational stories about what we think they mean. And we're having an argument and we believe exactly the same thing and we don't know. I think the most hysterical thing I ever saw were those signs that say, "Keep the government out of my Medicaid." What? So how we tell stories, what we believe, and it doesn't matter if you say to someone, "This isn't true." If they really believe it is true, they won't care. Their story is set. The only way you can change those stories is to tell them stories that resonate with them.
Can I just add on to that? Because I think there's...
Yeah, but let me prompt you and add on. Okay. Don't lose your thought. Don't lose your thought. And then we might have a question or two from the group because there's stickers involved. So I was thinking about the American story. Which means everything and nothing, right?
Yeah.
So we're at this point where we're trying to figure out, like, because you said, "I like to get the local stories," right? But we're this nation of 340 million people, whatever the census is. We got census people here. And 340 million people, 50 states, hundreds of communities, every background that you can imagine. And that is what is great about America, right? You travel the world, man. We're great at a lot of stuff, and we have so many people from so many different backgrounds. So what does the American story mean, and why does it matter? So I don't want you to lose your train of thought, but also, what do you think about the American story and how it means? And then we'll ask if anybody has a question. So.
Well, the first thing I wanted to say to go off of what Donna was saying is that one of the problems that I see all the time is that when people, like, no one knows your story better than you, right? I mean, sometimes we go to counselors and things like that to kind of get a, you know, outside perspective, but you know your story better than anybody, right? And what happens when we believe stories that other people tell about us, right, and people don't engage us, is they come and encounter us and they decide that you're something already, right, and they start telling you right. Who you are.
Donna's black, I noticed.
Yeah, she is.
Earlier.
Yes.
So,
this
yeah.
whole time.
So therefore, you know, there's all this stuff. And but, you have a beard, so you're evil.
Well.
Right, I know. I shouldn't have told everybody.
I mean, so, quit stating the obvious. But it's, you're not, when you go to someone, this is the problem when you start believing people that are telling stories for other people. You go to them and you take a read on them really quickly, and they might say one thing, and you act and treat them as if they are the story you've heard from someone else. You right. don't like it when someone comes over to you and starts telling you what you think, do you?
Right.
Especially when they are unqualified. The first time you ever met them, I see people on my Facebook page, and I'm a person who tries to post uniting things on my Facebook page, right? I'm a person who tries to remind people what we all have in common. And I see people go, They look at my thing and they go, this guy's a professor. I know what he's up to. I always joke that
I'm Dr. Sawyer.
Yes, Dr. Sawyer.
Dr.
Yeah.
Sawyer.
People that I grew up with in the country shooting at squirrels with BB guns are now like, that one, who is he? Where's he from? I'm like, we went through K-12 together. You know who I am.
You love to shoot squirrels.
I don't love to shoot squirrels. I'm not proud of that area in my life. But
right.
I will say that we did eat squirrels and rabbits from our yard every Thanksgiving when I was a kid.
Stop right there. Stop.
Okay. Stop. It's not true. It's not that. That's totally
stop.
True.
Stop. Go with
your anyway. But what I'm saying is, it's the funny thing is that I'm a person that, like, just because I grew up in the country, like, I like to go fishing, right? I go fishing on the weekends. I've got a four-wheel drive pickup truck because I build things in my house because I was a blue-collar worker, right? And I smoke cigars, right?
I always joke
that I'm the liberal in the cigar shop and the conservative on campus. And none of that actually has to do with anything that I think. It just has to do with them going, check, 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 this guy owns this, he owns that, he owns that. Therefore, I know what his story is. Mm-hmm. And then when I talk to people, I find that we actually pretty much get along. Mm-hmm. Now, for the American story, and this is crucial because this is what I teach in my classes. I think first and foremost, we have to understand that this story is our story. Mm-hmm. It's ours. This American story is the story of every single one of us in here. No one owns it. But people do see things different ways. And the narratives that we draw out of history, they very much rely because, as I said, stories are a simplification, right? They help us make our way in the world. They leave things out, and they have to, and that's effective sometimes. But the reality is every story has its silences, and every story has its noises. What we say and what we don't say are equally as powerful a lot of the time. And a lot of times people, what you need to know about history is that we're always learning new things. We're always, new science comes around, new archives become available, government documents get dropped, you find out crazy things about the past. Never mind, I'm not going to say it, but if you haven't seen the Warren G. Harding letters that came out about 6 years ago, go give yourself a laugh. But things get locked up and we find new things out. And in good faith, I think most of us are trying to make that story more effective. And you have to work harder to get some stories than you do other stories. So people that are in power leave documents behind. They always have. They leave diaries. They're literate. And those people have very accessible, like if I want to know what Thomas Jefferson thought about something, I can go to an online archive right now. But other people don't leave such obvious records. Enslaved people were kept from reading and writing. That means if you want to know about their lives, you've got to collaborate a lot of times with archaeologists, with anthropologists to fill in that story. That's a lot more work. It takes time to add those stories in.
And oral storytellers too, would I add
yes.
to that?
And all of this, what I'm saying is that, I'll stop now, but what I want to say is that we learn new things all the time. I think if you want an honest story about our country, You know, people say they're trying to rewrite history. We'll never forget that somebody wrote it the first time. And if we don't continue to adapt and understand our story to include new people in that story, then we lose out on things and we are constantly divided, because if we don't listen to the things that other people see that we don't, we miss out. And if we refuse to, because we decide we know what that person's story is already, we're going to be divided.
Well, one, there's the obligatory Warren G. Harding name check that Ben just tossed in. So I know how much you love the Warren G. Harding story. Donna, you give us your thoughts on that, or Warren G. Harding, whichever one you feel qualified to address.
To talk about.
What are you thinking?
Wow.
And then the question.
All right, I'll try to be as, I'm not good, but I'll try to be as concise as possible.
We're good.
All right. One of the best things that Dr. Sawyer has been talking about over and over again. Yes, I'm going to do it every time. You earned it, you get it. Is that if you want to understand people, don't listen to the stories other people tell about them. Listen to the stories they tell about themselves. That is what you have been saying over and over again. Listen to the stories they tell about themselves. And when we're talking about the American story, how many of you remember going through American history in school? Yeah? How many of you remember seeing yourself reflected back at you in the history book? How many of you remember seeing it and going, gosh, I want to be president someday? How many of you looked at that and thought that that was really what happened?
Oh, yeah.
I remember, I grew up in Asia. My dad was in the military. The first time I was ever in a homogeneous classroom was when I was in seventh grade. And we started talking about the Civil War. And it was the first time I remember being uncomfortable in a classroom, because everyone was looking at me out of the side of their eyes when they talked about the slaves, like somehow it had something to do with me. Like it was something that, I don't know, I should be ashamed of, me personally. And it was like a couple of paragraphs and then it was gone. Like we didn't talk much about it other than the emancipation. There was nothing in there really about what that was like. And then when we got to the Civil War, it was about states' rights. Slavery just sort of disappeared out of the textbook at that point. And I often wonder, what if we told that story differently? What if we told the story of what happens when you take a large group of people, a population, and you take them out indiscriminately and put them in pens on the Côte d'Ivoire? A lot of them are going to die, right? The weakest people, the sickest people, the people who can't survive that. They're not gonna survive it. But the people who are strong enough to find a way to live through it, they're gonna survive it. Take those same people, put them on a ship, send them across an ocean. More of them are going to die. The weakest people, the people who can't find a way to survive, they're not gonna survive that. On the other side of the ocean, what do you have? You have the strongest, angriest, most pissed off people in the world who are going to get through this no matter what. And that's the group they tried to enslave. If you look at it like that, Harriet Tubman is obvious. Frederick Douglass is obvious. Sojourner Truth is obvious. I am descendant from the people who survived a genocide. I'm not embarrassed about that. And I have no reason to be embarrassed. In fact, I am proud of what we survived. I didn't learn that in my history class.
Is that the American story?
The American story, from the point of view of my ancestors, is that.
Right.
The point of view from the Native American ancestors is that. The point of view from the Jews who immigrated here is that. The point of view from the Puritans was that. Every single group of Americans that have family here, old family, survived because they were coming to find something else. The American story is all of us have journeyed from one place here. And those the people that are already here survived us coming here. We are here because our ancestors chose to fight for this piece of land, no matter where they came from or what they look like. And ultimately, if we're going to go forward, we have to accept each other where we are and how we are. I am not less American than you are because I like to eat fancy cheese. I'm not less American than you are just because I like artisanal water, which I don't drink, but I might. I do not hunt, I do not fish, I love museums, and I read like a crazy lady. And I love libraries, and don't you dare cut the funding for libraries. I have stories about that, don't make me break them out.
I just want to say one last thing.
Does anybody have a question, by the way? Okay, I'll get one here. So I got somebody teed up, Ben.
This is great. This is the thing that I tell my students is that we, I see people walking around talking like 1776, like 1776. And look at it, I go, you know what happened in 1776? 32,000 British troops and the greatest fleet ever assembled at the time showed up in New York and just whipped George Washington for 6 months after that. I mean, like, we declared independence, but, you know, it wasn't exactly a good year for the United States. But what I say is, like, we think the American Revolution is this time. I actually think the revolution is this project we're in. I actually think we're living in the revolution. I think the revolution is a person who owned enslaved people saying all men are created equal, and then us spending 240 years trying to live up to that promise. And I think if you think about it like that, we don't look back and go, well, those were the great people. Those were the people who did everything.
Or the good old days.
The good old days.
What the heck is that about?
Right. We say this is ours. It's our inheritance. And what is the job of any good steward of an inheritance? It's to leave it better to the next generation than we inherited it. Yes. And we're all in that together.
Preach.
And so, you know, when was the American Revolution? Well, it's right now. It's that promise, the Enlightenment. Yeah. As Dr. King said in the I Have a Dream speech, we've come here today to cash a check. Yeah. That promise was written to us and has never been cashed. Mm-hmm. Now, we've been working on cashing that check. But all of us need to continue to see ourselves as part of the American Revolution, as part of this promise, if we're not going to go bankrupt and, you know, that check's going to bounce.
And I will go fishing with you as long as I don't have to catch fish.
I got a boat.
Scott Kaiser, the Assistant Secretary of the Illinois Senate, is here to ask a question. And
really, I didn't have a question. I just wanted one of the tokens.
Okay.
And I got one now, so it's and I got the mic.
Illinois,
so.
You were lucky to have such a strategic thinker in your legislature.
I'm saying.
You guys are very entertaining. This is a great session. And the reason I came was to get your thoughts on this question. So when new legislators come into the Illinois Senate, if I get a chance, one of the things I like to suggest to them is to make a friend on the other, you know, a Democrat on the Republican side, Republican on the Democratic side, even within your own party.
And you work for the Republicans.
I technically work for the Republicans. Yeah. And one of the things, you know, we have so many keyboard cowards now, I think.
Keyboard cowards.
Yes.
Where they sit behind a screen
like
and take each other down. So I think we all, legislators, legislative staff, would agree we need more, we call it civility, but really it's politeness. It's much more simple than that. You guys talk, I think, mostly to groups. And so if you're a legislator, how would you suggest that one-on-one communication between a legislator and a colleague to get that relationship going so that they can work together?
All right. How many of you have had a conversation this week? Right. Did you talk about your family? Did you talk about your pets? Did you talk about where you grew up? Did you talk about what you like? That's the answer. You're going to be colleagues. Be colleagues. What do colleagues know about each other? They know their stuff. And the more you know somebody, the more stuff you know. I would say that before you, as you're getting to know someone, don't talk about politics. Because politics is what happens after you try to solve a problem and you have different points of view. getting to know people is about knowing their stuff. So I would say that the best way to deal with that is to tell stories about your stuff, which is how you make friends.
But this is the business of politics.
I understand that. So, yeah. But if you're going to do the business of politics, you have to have a relationship first. The relationship must come first. Because if you have a relationship, well, sort of like the kid who's like, oh my God, she's black. That's all he got. But after we were sharing stories, that wasn't even the issue. He wanted stories.
Right.
So it's the stories that you share. And I don't know how you, how many of you have one story that all your friends know about you? Right. There's one story. And then there are stories you don't tell but a few people. And then there are stories you tell selectively. So I would say, you know, figure out a story that you can share with the person you're, and also, how many of you have interesting stories? Like, I once made a triple out all by myself when I was 12. A lot of people don't have that story. That's a great story. I usually don't tell people that story. It doesn't, until I know them for a long time. But just because it doesn't come up, think about stories like that. How do you let people know what you love and what's important to you without telling them where you came from or what your politics are? It's totally possible to do. I bet all y'all been doing it all week.
Yeah, I was going to say, I normally don't tell many people that I ate squirrels at Thanksgiving, but...
I know you better because of that now, Ben.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We don't do it anymore. We've evolved. But we feed the squirrels now. But look, here's, all right, so I've worked with NCSO. I've been fortunate enough to work with NCSO. I love this organization. I love that there is a nonpartisan organization meant to cultivate. I mean, seriously. Seeing what you guys do, I mean, again, seeing people sitting down. I do trivia nights. If anybody's been here to the online Zoom trivia nights, man, it's like, it's been great. Tim came to me, I remember the first time, and he said, I want you to do a trivia night, but I need you to do a trivia night where if you end up with a California Democrat and an Alabama Republican in the same room, the questions aren't going to make them fight. And I said, I can do that. I can do that. To me, it's not even a thought because I have a job as a history professor. If I walk in there with 1 ounce of political motivation, I've shut off half the room. I'm not doing my job. So I know how to do these things. And the fact that I found an organization to work with that cares about that as much as I do, it matters to me. But one of the things that I found out from sitting down and having lunch with state legislators, with being in touch with my own state legislators, with having a great conversation with some Tennessee legislators about helping our veterans with policy after the last time I was here in 2019, the thing that I figured out is that you guys are all here to serve. There's no ego associated with most of you guys. I mean, well, Tim looked at me like, me, obviously, but...
to have some ego to run for office, right?
Sure, but nobody's like, you know what I'm saying? Nobody's like going to be blown. It's like me. It's like I got a PhD from Michigan State. Nobody goes, whoa.
Well, I don't know.
Right? It's like you got to hustle for it, right? You got to hustle for that recognition. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that's common ground, right? You're working in a world where, unfortunately, most people don't even know who their state legislators are.
17% of people do.
17%. That's the glass is 17% full, Tim.
Most people don't even know what the government does.
I know. You know how hard it is to tell my students that originally senators were elected by state legislators? They go, what? I said, state legislators. They're like, so the legislature? I'm like, legislature is a vague word. Which one do you mean? And they're like, huh? It's hard. But state legislators, I even joke with them. I said, I'm going to go talk to some state legislators tomorrow. We'll see how upset they are about the 17th Amendment. But anyway, but my point is, it seems to me like if you went through the process of going through this struggle, you know that you're all there to serve and you all have a story, but at some point you realize that was something you cared about and wanted to do. And that is a lot of common ground. So, I mean, as someone who doesn't serve in the state legislature, but someone who's spoken to a lot of folks, I'll bet that if two people sat down and say, hey, what made you run for office? You'd find common ground because it's service.
That's right.
And your story, your personal story, is there on the table about how you came to that. And once you know someone's personal story, it's real hard to hate them.
Yeah.
So we have like 5 minutes left. What the heck happened? No, we're lightning round questions. So we're going to do one lightning round question and then tell us a story to send us forth. Ben, you'll go first, but after this question, because we're going to go over time and I'm going to hear from the boss and it's going to be terrible. So quick story, quick question.
It's a twofold.
Okay. Oh, no. Okay.
But it's quick. So I've heard you talk about sort of everybody has their own story. And then you've talked about the business of politics. So in this context of service and politics, which are intertwined, how do you build relationship and have conversations as well as work on problems together if someone is so rooted in the situations where someone is so rooted in their own personal story or rooted in the business of trying to win that they can't get past it to go where they really want to go? They're compelled. And I've had those. I have relationships where I may not be able to go so far because of either one of those two things. So I'll say that understanding.
Maybe your district will not let you go there.
Maybe. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the problems I think that occurs is sometimes in politics, you tell stories that will get you elected, but not stories that will help you govern. So when it comes time to actually governing, I think the first thing that might help is for each of you to say what you want to accomplish, as opposed to someone saying, this is what I'd like to accomplish, and that person going, nah, we're not doing that. Why don't you, that might be a way to go forward. Put all the cards on the table. This is what I would like to accomplish. This is what I would like to accomplish. How do we get there? As opposed to one person simply offering nothing or just being combative. That's just compromise, which is kind of what our government is supposed to be about, right?
You can't say that in here.
Yes, you can.
I'm going to say it anyway.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Don't say that. Anyway, so the business of putting it on the table, but again, it's about stories and also why that's important to you. If you can tell a story about why something is important to you, when you learn other people's stories, it's hard to hate them and it's hard to fight them. You're not saying, do this because I want it. Do this because, or I want to do this because there are children who have no access to books if you don't have a library in their community.
So Ben, bring us home and then you bring us home from wherever he brings us home.
Gotcha, no problem.
All right, Ben.
I mean, I think you get, what I try to do with my students when I sit down one-on-one and talk about them is I listen to them. Right, and I have students who will come in all flustered, right? Really upset about fixated on one particular thing. But if you let them talk, ask them questions, you get back to the fact that, I mean, I think, and this is something that doesn't seem remarkable to most of you guys, but if you believe, just real quick, if you believe that a person's lot in life, if a person works hard, that they deserve to have a good life. How many of you guys think that? If a person works hard. Now, that might not be the only person you think deserves to have a good life, but we think that. Now, that's not the way monarchy works. That's not the way nationalism works. A monarchy, it's bloodline. Nationalism, ethnic nationalism is bloodline. But we understand that if you work hard in this country, and this one thing we agree on, we forget about, is that we care about hard work and that a person rises to their merit. And I think that if you start asking a person a question, they might get down to the point that, why do I think like that? Is it about me? But if you don't ask questions and listen in good faith, they're not going to speak to you. And I think asking questions is an act of showing love. I care about what you have to say. And I think when you do that, it disarms people because most people just want to tell other people what's going on. That's just my advice. As someone who's never legislated, God bless all of you.
Yeah, that's what I say. Yeah.
Nice job, Ben. Nice job. Donald, final thoughts here.
Final thoughts?
Story.
You want a quick story?
Yeah.
Quick story. My son, when he was 4 years old, used to love the Fairly Odd Parents. And this is this thing where this little boy has terrible parents and he's got fairy godparents and they just grant all his wishes. And my son was 4, he's in the bathtub. He says to me, Mom, that Timmy Turner doesn't make good wishes. I said, why? What did he wish for? He said, he wished that everyone's Halloween costume would be real. I said, why is that bad? He said, Mom, have you seen people's Halloween costumes? That's a bad wish. And I said, and that would be bad if they were all real. He said, yeah, because if they were real, the the world wouldn't be the good, sweet, safe place it is. My son was 4.
Ooh.
I hope that all of us, as we go forward, work to get rid of the spooky things that populate our government and cause us to not see that the world could be a good, sweet, safe place.
Amen. Amen. Go forth and make the world a good, spooky, safe place. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, guys. That was
fantastic.
Thank
you guys for coming.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word. Text a link to a friend, share a link on social media, or take a minute to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. All of this helps us spread the word about our show. So if you've already done that, thank you. Speaking of thank you, now's the time where we say the special shout out to our supporters on Patreon, with particular emphasis on our Washingtonians. Thank you to Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Big White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Ann Williams, and Frank Edwards, and Daniel Hansen. To all of you, we are grateful. If you're enjoying what you hear on The Road to Now, you can join us there on Patreon too. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. There are extra episodes, bonus materials, and you can even join us for an upcoming trivia night or live recordings. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. Our patrons keep us going. For more on this episode and our podcast in general, please visit our website, www.theroadtonow.com, where you can easily search our back catalog and quickly find links to content. You're going to be amazed by that website. And you want to know why? Because it was designed by Charles and Destiny at Seven Ages Design. Go check those guys out. They made our lives a lot easier and made us look a lot better. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music is by Paul DeFiglia. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thank you for listening. Take care.